Christian Blood, KTSA News.
This is a jacked up day today, and I'm not saying that because that's my name. There is a lot going on and a lot of crazy upheaval and things that we're going to kind of make sense of. We're going to try to put the room back in order for you here in the next few hours. Welcome to our show. Join the show at 210-599-5555. It seems like just yesterday, because it was, that the Supreme Court extended a block on SB 4, which is the bill that was signed by Governor Abbott back, I think, in November or December, that would allow local law enforcement to do border enforcement, to detain people, have administrative hearings, and even initiate deportation of people in the country illegally. The Supreme Court had extended a block on that, but now is allowing that law to go into force. SB 4 will now be allowed to go into effect, which is at least a temporary win for the state of Texas and for this country. It is, however, unexpected by a lot of us, because you would look at the extending of the injunction, the litigation of the case in the lower courts, and the prospects for SB 4 were not good. In arguing against it, the Department of Justice said in part, Texas cannot run its own immigration system. Well, we're really not running our own immigration system. We're running yours, DOJ. We're running the federal government's system that the current administration has simply opted out of. And what's going to be interesting about this, and I said this a while back, is will other states look at other things that they have presumed only the federal government could do and say, we could do that better, we could do that in a more responsive, meaningful way, we understand the situation, we're closer, we've got the nuances, whatever. This potentially opens the door to other things being questioned. At the same time, I'm sure that the Biden administration will not take this lying down, and I'm sure there's much more to come on this. And you can imagine now, I don't want to get too far ahead of the story, but you can imagine what we're going to be hearing in the next 12 to 24 hours in terms of re-ramping up the condemnation of the Supreme Court, the calls to pack the court, do away with the court. Anytime the left gets its nose bloodied in the Supreme Court, its reaction is always that the Supreme Court needs to go. So they can only win, they can only be affirmed, they can never, ever be reversed if the Supreme Court is to have any legitimacy. Now, the Supreme Court is in the news today in another way, in a case called Murthy versus Missouri, which was originally called Missouri versus Biden. This is the case, the First Amendment case, involving the federal government and social media. And this is two states, Missouri and Louisiana, and getting joined as amicus curiae by a number of other states, saying that the federal government, this administration, pressured, instructed, directed social media companies to take down certain posts and content providers. These tended to be conservative or people that were skeptical of the COVID vaccine and the direction that was coming from the federal government on COVID. So they were censoring certain viewpoints the Biden administration didn't like, doing that work that the Biden administration itself could not directly do. And it's not censorship, technically, because it's not the government doing it. It's these social media companies. So the government's argument was, look, we just gave them some recommendations. The argument from the states was, no, you pressured them, you ordered them, you colluded with them, and they should be blocked from doing that unless it is material involving illegal activity. Like if the federal government said, that's a video on how to make a dirty bomb, or that's a page from a terrorist organization, But except for those rare occasions, the government shouldn't be giving that direction or that coercion or whatever. So they got last year they got a judge to put an injunction on the administration. The Fifth Circuit found that there was some coercion, but they narrowed the injunction, so they lifted most of the original judge's injunction. The Supreme Court initially stayed the Fifth Circuit Court's order and is now reviewing the case. And we're going to bring our legal expert in on this shortly to talk a little bit about what's going on with the Missouri case, which is the social media case, and also SB4. And I want to talk about that. It's stunning to me what we're seeing right now in terms of how the sides are being chosen. When I was young, and maybe you remember this too, American liberals were the strongest voices against censorship, against any limits on free speech. Remember, it was liberal lawyers that would defend guys like Larry Flint. It was always the argument that don't get in the way of any speech. Let everything enter the marketplace. Let everything enter the public square. The best answer to objectionable speech is more speech. And we don't trust anybody in authority. Remember those buttons the radicals used to wear, question authority? We don't trust anyone in authority to police language. The First Amendment was their sacrament, okay? To watch the flip-flop of this to where now the left is begging for the policing of language, is now begging for censorship. And it's hard not to think that they're doing that because they're in power. When they were not in favor of it, they were often on the outside looking in. Now that they're in power, they're showing their true colors. They like authoritarianism. They want more power. They want to be the ones wielding it. Of course, they're not thinking that at some point down the road, these powers they are cheerleading for the federal government to have could be in the hands of a federal government headed by one of their opponents, by somebody they dislike or distrust. Not thinking of that, not caring about that. I guess presuming that they will always be in power or always be in favor with whoever is. There was an astonishing moment in terms of what's going to happen to our free speech rights. And this is about more than social media. Like, I know a lot of people hear that and they think, well, I don't use it or I don't care about it or whatever. But this has implications for each and every one of us, whatever our involvement is or lack of involvement with social media. There was a moment when Justice Jackson, hearing the case and going back and forth with the lawyers, and as I mentioned, the lawyers from Missouri and Louisiana pitted against the Department of Justice lawyers, she asked whether the First Amendment might be, quote, hamstringing the federal government, meaning that the federal government would be unable to do something it wanted to do because of this interpretation of the First Amendment. She said, my biggest concern is that your view of the First Amendment hamstrings the federal government in significant ways in the most important time periods. And so I guess some might say, she went on, that the government has a duty to take steps to protect the citizens of this country, and you seem to be suggesting that that duty cannot manifest itself in the government encouraging or even pressuring platforms to take down harmful information. The very purpose of the First Amendment is to hamstring the state. She's wondering if that might happen. That is literally what happens, what it has done. The whole point, the whole outlook of the Bill of Rights is that it's about you and me. It's rights for you and me. It's not rights for the government. It's not rights for the executive branch or the legislative branch or the judicial branch. It's not about making government easier or getting out of the way of our overlords. To hear somebody who's been to one of the leading law schools in the country, who's on the highest court in the country, actually wondering if the First Amendment might inhibit the government from limiting speech. I mean, you'd get an F in, freshman law school. I mean, it's literally the dumbest, most obtuse thing you could say about the First Amendment. I almost hope that it's been misreported, because if this is really what she said, she literally has missed the point of the First Amendment. That is the point of the Bill of Rights. The government's powers derive from and are subservient to us. We would be in much more trouble if the First Amendment did not hamstring the government. And it's hard to know whether somebody like this is silly or dangerous. This is one of the foundational principles of the United States. And it's so concerning to hear this in the midst of a case that will have so much to do with future First Amendment issues, even though, again, we don't have the ruling yet. We don't know how the ruling will go. We're going to talk about this with Victor Davis Hanson coming up. He's going to join the show in about 20 minutes, less than 20 minutes, and that's one of the things we will definitely talk to him about when he joins us. But that is sobering. A little more about the Missouri case. It kind of sounds like the justices are erring on the side of the government needs to protect you and me rather than protect our free speech rights. So in other words, you and I were raised to believe that free speech is like a marketplace where ideas enter and exit and can be countered and competed over. You claim this, I can claim that. We might debate. We might both just yell. People can decide, can hear it all and decide. But the new view is that the government needs to weed out of that marketplace ideas that no one should ever hear. No one should think about them. No one should wonder about them. Now, who is making that decision? Well, somebody who's much, much better than you, much smarter than you, much more virtuous than you, somebody who's protecting you from you. Think about what we went through the last few years with COVID. Do you feel like the people that didn't want you to hear about ivermectin, the people that didn't want you to hear about some of the injuries caused by the vaccine, people that didn't want you to question the model of closing down schools and societies, were you better off, do you think? Were you well served, do you think, by silencing those questioners and skeptics and doubters? Because many of them were silenced or ostracized or fired from their jobs. Did that make the experience we all went through with COVID better? And COVID is just one example. But it's what happens when you decide that people can't shop in the marketplace themselves, but instead somebody has to pick and choose info and opinions that are safe to be in your cart for you. And that's what they're arguing about before the Supreme Court. It's a little scary that the basis for this case isn't, oh no, the government should never pick and choose and shop for us. Instead, these justices seem to be deciding not if that's okay, but just how far that's okay. I hope, and it's often the case, that you can't predict how a Supreme Court decision will be rendered based on the oral arguments and the questions from the judges. Very often, it's not a good indicator, and we've been wrong many times when we thought we knew the direction that a prominent case was going. I hope that's the case here. Is the First Amendment a real thing that is always in effect, whether there's war or peace or health or a pandemic, or is daddy government supposed to put things in our shopping cart in the marketplace of ideas and only let us pick out the things that are good for us in the government's opinion? And make sure we never hear about stuff that they consider dangerous or harmful. Does that sound good to you? Let's talk about that. Well, you might think right now that you're listening to a radio station or listening to a stream or listening to a podcast, but you're also shopping right now. You're shopping right now. You're in a marketplace of ideas. I'm here saying stuff that comes into my head, and you are discerning whether or not it has value to you, whether you want to spend time with this guy or not, and if you want to hang out for a little while or a long time or go away. Those are all decisions you're free to make and you're making. I am presenting what I present every day up against numerous competitors, everything from other radio stations to podcasters to various content that's all over the internet and all over the airwaves. And this is the marketplace of ideas. I can't make you do anything. I can't make you believe anything. I can't make you agree with me. There probably are days you do agree with me and days you don't. Just like when you go to a store, you don't buy everything on the shelf. You pick up some things and put them back, and you pick up some things and put them in your wagon, and some things you roll on past because you got no use for them. And that's how it should be, and that's how it has been, and that's what the First Amendment protects. We have people now who believe and have been taught, I think, to believe that that marketplace is dangerous. Now, I mean, HEB is dangerous. I mean, there's stuff at HEB that could kill you. You know, you eat too much of this or too many of those, or you have an unbalanced diet. You could shop and eat yourself to death at your favorite supermarket. And if you do, that's on you. Because the information is out there, but you may or may not choose to use it to design a good diet. But would you rather go to the store and pick out your own things? Or are you so afraid of the world that you want someone else to do it? And I don't mean like you're having your groceries delivered. I mean like, you don't want the choices. Don't present me these alternative points of view. I don't want to hear them. Just tell me what's true, and I'll only consume that. And in surveys, more and more people are saying that around the world. In places where they have the freedom, they're saying, take it away from us. Meanwhile, in places where they don't have that freedom, they're trying to get here. We are the country the world is trying to come into. And there's many reasons for that, but certainly one of them is, and it may be why your ancestors came here, and it's certainly why my ancestors came here, because they'd be freer. And they were getting away from places where somebody who thought they were better than you, or had more money than you, or had a birthright better than yours, made the decisions for you about your life. So it's very weird to me that we are even arguing about this. It's very weird to me that we have this treasure, this God-given right, and we are arguing amongst ourselves about taking it away from everyone. Again, if somebody didn't want to go to the supermarket, I'm just overwhelmed by the choices. Okay, don't go. They want to take those choices when it comes to speech, ideas, opinions. They want to take those away from everyone. And there's this idea that we can trust the authorities, people in authority. But look at what the people in authority have done with the trust you've already given them. Let's look at the record. Let's look at all the things they've lied about and covered up. Just this week, the mainstream media, one of the primary institutions of the elites in this country, one of the pillars of the establishment of this country, has completely fabricated an event in the presidential campaign of their opponent and lied bald-faced to you about what he said. And they're angry that they're being challenged on it. They're angry that they're being called out on it. Do these seem like people that should decide what you get to hear and what gets posted and what doesn't and who has a page and who doesn't and who has an account and who doesn't? Do these people demonstrate any fitness for this? I don't get it. And I don't know where the old left went, who would have been the first ones, the ACLU, and they would have been the first ones to say, don't ever fall for that. Don't ever give that First Amendment away. It's the most important part of the Bill of Rights. Next guest is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, Victor Davis Hanson, joining us on the KTSA Connecticut Quality Water Softeners Newsmaker Line. Always an honor to have you back, sir. Thank you for coming on today.
Thank you for having me.
I was juxtaposing a minute ago the sort of the dual stories of the day. You have right in front of our eyes people constructing this hoax about Donald Trump calling for a bloodbath if he doesn't win the election. And you have the Supreme Court arguing the merits of giving people in authority the right to pick and choose in the information marketplace the things we should hear and know and see. And it's just mind-boggling to me that we're even at the point where we would be considering that.
Yeah, I think things have changed. I don't know what was the revolutionary moment, but something about the Donald Trump candidacy, the COVID lockdown, the George Floyd riot. We went into a period where the country, whether it's the border or civil rights or free speech or the woke DEI, whatever we want to call it, on the universities and our downtowns, it's unrecognizable. I think this is just part of that playing out. I mean, in the case of Donald Trump, I don't think anybody ever imagined that the leading candidate of a political party would be subject to four criminal suits and one civil suit. He probably owes $500 million in legal fees and fines and interest on them, and a blatant attempt to destroy someone. So this is all new territory. We've never been here before.
Mm-hmm. When you hear a justice of the Supreme Court, Justice Jackson, worry that the First Amendment might be hamstringing the government, her words, what goes through your mind?
Well, I work at a university, so I've watched this the last 15 years. I think everybody should be very clear about the left doesn't believe in the First Amendment anymore. They call that disinformation or misinformation. Speech that they do not like, they call hate speech. So they've been attacking. There is no First Amendment for all practical purposes on a university campus. If I were to go at Stanford University and say that I was an adamant opponent of abortion, or I did not believe in affirmative action, and I said that out in free speech, I'd probably be fired. And I think everybody understands that. And it's just the way it is. If I go to a particular campus and I were to say something as an invited speaker, it was perfectly within the bounds of acceptable discourse, but came from the right or the conservative point of view, I'd probably be, and I have been, mobbed or shouted down. So I think that's just the way it is. The left, who in the 1960s was pro-pornography, don't ban risque movies, except a deep throat is your constitutional right, they flipped on this. They want to restrict freedom of expression and freedom of speech.
Is it because they were not in power when they were saying those things and now they are?
Yeah, I think in power means not just who was president, but the popular culture, or they feel that they did not control all of the institutions. There were the churches, the religion, formalized religion foundations. There were conservatives still in Hollywood. There were, K through 12. Was neutral, and now they feel that all of the major institutions that wield power and influence are in their control, all of them. Media, newspapers, traditional media, the NPR, PBS, corporate boardroom, you name it, entertainment, Hollywood, professional sports. So they feel that they can do these things now. They don't feel they have 51% of the population of the electorate. And they don't, but that makes them even more zealous and adamant to change the process. So they're always talking about packing the court or ending the filibuster when they're in the majority in the Senate, or getting rid of the Electoral College, or bringing in Puerto Rico or D.C. It's their way of getting Trump off the ballot. They don't look at just having an election to adjudicate who's going to control things. They look at changing the system to favor themselves, and they feel that it's moral and perfectly okay because they're morally superior to the rest of us in any means necessary, justified by their morally and ethically superior ends.
Laura Ingraham asked you last night on Fox if this was a tipping point, the hoax with Trump's bloodbath comment, which is so amateurish and obviously debunkable, something people can now, because of modern technology, people can now verify for themselves what he actually said. Do you feel like this is a moment of overreach or a tipping point?
Yeah, I think we kind of hit it also with the E. Jean Carroll, $83 million, and the Letitia James, $355 million. But I think what was key about the bloodbath was a lot of us had said, we wish Donald Trump didn't use the word bird brain, or he's got to get more independent or swing voters, he's got to be more careful. And I think this now says, yeah, he should, but no matter what he says, it's not going to matter. Because that was clearly about the automotive institution and industry. And it's clear that the left uses bloodbath all the time in a various context. So I think people kind of said, I wish Trump would kind of, reach out to people by not being so abrasive. But you know what? After this, it's not going to matter. Whatever he says, we're going to distort and manipulate. So I think that was what was a turning point.
Do you think populist is the right term for him? And does the left understand populism? Because as you pointed out, they never worry about having a majority. They only worry about being able to leverage what they do have.
Well, they like to use the word progressive, which means elitist, basically. But when they look at populism, they have a whole bunch of synonyms, and we know where they come from. For Obama, a populist was a clinger. For Hillary, they were an irredeemable or a deplorable. For Biden, he's called them dregs and chumps. McCain called them crazies and hobbits. But what they mean is people who are distrustful of the administrative state, the bicoastal elite, and the power that's in Washington, the administrative state that does not seem to change. And what they're doing to Donald Trump, they feel they can do it to anybody. And they're very suspicious. Yeah. Anthony Fauci, Birx, the lockdown, they knew that was going to do more damage than the virus, but they couldn't stop it.
But it is interesting to watch people in the Democratic base start to peel away on the basis of realizing the same things you just described, that the prosecution is a banana republic persecution. It's different when the people they most count on, the Democratic Party most counts on, are becoming revulsed with these tactics, isn't it?
Yeah, I think what's happening is among independents or swing voters, there's a lot of people who feel this is overkill and this is overreach and the country would not be sustainable if both sides did it. And then I think the Latino and black base of the Democratic Party, at least males, black males and Latino males who live in blue states especially, are saying the elite, bicoastal elite, the woke elite don't represent us. They're sort of like the people of East Palestine. The poor white working class does not have anything in common with the Bill Gates and the Mark Zuckerbergs and those people. So, and I think the minority communities are now saying, well, yeah, these people say that there are representatives, the Black Caucus or Joy Reid or you name it, the Latino Caucus, but they don't represent us. They don't care about us. They don't care about what the border's done to the inner city. They don't care about what homelessness is doing. They don't see that we don't like abortion on demand. We don't like homeless people everywhere. And so I think that's what's really frightening the Democratic Party, because they have so alienated the white working class that if you start to lose the swing voter, suburbanite, and you lose 40 or 50% of the Latino vote, maybe 20% of the black vote, it's not mathematically possible to win. And they're aware of that now, and I think that's why they're doing things like bloodbath and trying to get him off the ballot and these five lawsuits. And so they have to find another means, and I think we're going to see some things on the election we've never seen before with mail-in and early ballots.
Well, that, and you also wonder what the aftermath of the election will look like when it's clearly no longer a scenario where the side that lost cheerfully or even humorously accepts it. I remember when losing presidential candidates would quip about losing Bob Dole made a joke about it. He said, "I slept like a baby. I woke up every 2 hours crying." We're not going to see that again anytime soon. There is total mistrust of an election you lose.
Yeah, I think most people are saying to themselves, "We woke up, and all of a sudden in these states the laws were changed." So typically there was such a thing called an absentee ballot. Typically they were 4 or 5% rejected because you couldn't authenticate them. And suddenly they changed the name to mail-in ballot or early balloting. And now it's 70% of the people don't show up on election day, and yet the rejection rate decreased by a magnitude of 10. So everybody's saying, well, these ballots just swarm in, and surely they must be more inauthentic or not genuine ballots, but suddenly there's only a tenth being rejected, mm-hmm. even though they have no face-to-face contact with the polls. So they're thinking, I'm going to turn on the TV in November, and Donald Trump is going to be ahead all night long, and then suddenly right when I go to bed, mm-hmm. these dumps are going to start occurring, and we're going to see these numbers just flip. And I think that really creates cynicism, because you can't have 70% of the electorate not showing up on election day with only a 0.4 reject. 99.6% of all those ballots yep. will be validated. They don't do that anywhere in Europe. They wouldn't do it.
That's a great point. Victor Davis Hanson, always appreciate your time, sir. Thanks for coming on today.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you again. The JR poll, powered by River City Oral Surgery. Today the question is, should social media companies take direction from this or any administration? Do you want social media companies to censor, take down, deplatform based on the direction of a government entity? And I, you know, what's really weird to me about all of this is that you hear people complain, or maybe it's not always a complaint, but at least it's an observation, right? Like, how many times have you heard somebody say, I think my phone listens to me, you know, I'll say something to somebody and then there's a banner ad on my phone. Or I think my cable box listens to me in my living room because this, that, and the other. People are sort of selective about the stuff that makes them feel creepy or uncomfortable. I'm thinking, look at these politicians. Look at them. They're not better than us. It's the biggest collection of weirdos and pervs and freaks and ne'er-do-wells you ever saw in your life, you know? George Santos, you know, I mean, the idea that you would look at the government, which is these people, and go, well, they can keep me from hearing something or reading something that I shouldn't ought to know. But I guess what people are doing is they're not saying it about themselves. We all think we're smart enough, but we think, well, our kids shouldn't see this stuff, or people that don't know better shouldn't see this stuff. I'm smart, I know, but those knuckle-draggers that vote differently than me or worship differently than me or look differently than me, we can't have them reading this stuff or hearing this stuff on X or what have you. And again, there is no one. Whoever you're waiting for is not coming. There isn't anyone better than you or me to decide what to consume and what to think about and what to question. You can't delegate that. They just have an agenda. They'll just do stuff and tailor it to the furtherance of their own power and their own enriching. Now, I looked this up because I vaguely remembered it. This is an article from February, CNBC.com, February 19th. It's about a company called XPeng, which makes cars in China and uses AI. And it's the CEO of XPeng talking to CNBC about what's going to happen in the auto industry. And he says the intense competition in the electric vehicle space could end in a bloodbath. And this kind of terminology has been around for a long time in the auto industry. the Alliance for American Auto Manufacturing describes China's cheap labor market this way. The introduction of cheap Chinese autos, which are so inexpensive because they are backed with the power and funding of the Chinese government, to the American market, could end up being an extinction-level event for the U.S. auto sector. Gee, that sounds like another way of saying bloodbath, an extinction-level event. So everyone in the auto industry, people that write about it, have long made dire and colorful observations about what is looming ahead, what is in the road ahead. And whether you like it or not, or believe it or not, or we disagree about what to do about it or not, Trump's not making a novel or unique observation. He didn't even use a novel or unique word to describe it. In the news that we talk about is this man, Donald Trump. And I have people tell me, I wish you didn't talk about him so much, or I wish he wasn't in the news so much. And, you know, it's interesting. For all the things that are going on around him, the legal cases, the hoax of the bloodbath comment, comparing him to Hitler, isn't it interesting that they never, not just me, I mean, this show reflects what's going on. Obviously, this show is a reflection of what's in our world, what's in our lives. But isn't it interesting that they can do anything to him except get him out of their heads? They just can't. He told a story one time when he first became president, Donald Trump, about how when he would wake up in the morning, and he wakes up early, he would put on the TV, and every president of the United States since Lyndon Johnson has been obsessed with his TV coverage. Lyndon Johnson famously installed three side-by-side-by-side televisions in the Oval Office. It had never been done before because he wanted to be able to watch all three networks simultaneously do the evening news. And you could see that, by the way, at the LBJ Library. It's a fascinating mock-up. But every president is fascinated. Trump, however, handles it differently. He told a story about how he would turn on the TV, he would watch the news, and if he didn't like what they were saying about him, then he would pull out his phone, and he said this: "I will tweet something that makes them all change to breaking news and a completely different story based on my tweet." And he said this laughing, because he actually is pulling their strings. I know that if you're a Trump supporter, you think of these people as tormenting him, but I would point out he is also tormenting them. They don't like him, but they need him. They need him for ratings. And when I see the words breaking news on a television screen, I don't always think that's something I need to know, but I always know that's something they need me to look at. They need my eyeballs glued to that screen. Whatever they're about to do, they're trying to grab me and get my attention. And he grabs them and gets their attention. And it's interesting how the most powerful man in the world at that time, because he was president, was manipulating his own news media. And if you said this to those people, they would deny it angrily. They would say, no, we decide. But I think he decides. I think he lives inside their heads rent-free. And I think when they talk about the Trump properties and Letitia James is going to seize the Trump properties and she's going to put a padlock on Trump Tower and all this other stuff, the Trump properties are CNN, MSNBC, Fox, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the network news departments, news divisions. He knows them. This is our first television star president. I know Ronald Reagan was on television before he became president. He had been a movie actor too, but clearly that wasn't his main preparation for becoming president. Donald Trump, who is a businessman, was also a television star. He gets the medium. He gets Twitter. When they write the history of Twitter, he will be one of the most formative users of it. Think how many people have a Twitter account just to follow him. Wouldn't have probably gotten involved otherwise. And when I watch his manipulation of them, what's interesting to me is I think the stuff they claim he's going to do, the bloodbath, the dictatorship, the weaponizing government to get back and get revenge, those are all the things they do. In other words, they're projecting onto him what they do. When they get into power, they weaponize the IRS. They call the social media companies. They try to deplatform their opponents or their skeptics. Everything they say he's going to do is stuff they're doing and have done. And I guess they assume, somebody said this recently, and I can't take credit for it, but it's a very brilliant observation. I guess they assume that he is just like them. They figure, well, if we were being treated the way he is, and if we were going through what he's going through, and we got the chance for revenge, we take it with relish, so we assume he's going to do that. We tell everyone he's going to do that, because that's what we would do if we were in his position. But for all the put-downs and all the names they call him, they cannot let go. They really can't. I mean, they'll tell you, it's an important story and history's being made and democracy dies in darkness. But the truth is that they can't, they don't know how to organize and define themselves without having him as their scratching post. What are they really for? What are they in favor of? Well, really, it's just stopping him. I mean, look at the guy that look at the alternative. They're not for him. Nobody's for Biden. Biden is just the repository of Stop Trump. 210-599-5555. It's very interesting, speaking of the media, to watch how all the rats are deserting the sinking ship of the SS Fannie Willis. Have you noticed in recent days, all the pundits now think she should remove herself from the case? That used to be something that Trump said because he was racist and hated strong women, but now they all say it. I wonder if it's because she's a real threat to the case, and they know that or they see that. And on our Connecticut Quality Water Softeners Newsmaker line, Professor of Law at St. Mary's University School of Law, Bill Pyatt. Professor, good afternoon. Thanks for making time for us.
Thank you, Jack.
We're going to wring a lot of work out of you here in the next few minutes because there's a lot going on. The Supreme Court decision allowing SB 4 to take effect, can you kind of walk us through what that means? Because that still has to be litigated in the Fifth Circuit Court, right?
Yes. Actually, what they did is they are going to allow Texas to enforce Senate Bill 4 that allows state law enforcement officials in Texas to arrest individuals who they suspect of entering the United States illegally, and judges in Texas could, in effect, deport those people. Now, what they've done, though, the Supreme Court has sent it back to the Fifth Circuit. So, in this kind of ping-pong game that's going on, the Fifth Circuit now has the case. The Fifth Circuit has scheduled arguments, but the Fifth Circuit could block the law again to leave it out of pending so that it wouldn't be put into effect. But unless and until that happens, the law is in effect, and Texas law enforcement can start arresting, detaining people, and deporting people.
Now, is it usual or unusual or common to allow the law to take effect even though it hasn't finished being reviewed by the courts?
Well, it depends on the nature of the law, but it is unusual for a stay to be entered and then reversed in the way that this was. But there's many things that are unusual about this case. On the ultimate decision, the Fifth Circuit has to decide whether the state of Texas has the constitutional authority to enforce its own immigration law, and then the Supreme Court is going to review that. The last time the Supreme Court reviewed this issue in 2012 was in a case brought involving the state of Arizona that was doing something similar to what Texas is doing. The Supreme Court then said that states don't have that power. That is, they don't have the power to enforce immigration laws. Mm-hmm. So this would be, if the Supreme Court continues to allow Texas to enforce its law, it's a dramatic reversal of that position.
Does it open the door for other things that states have deferred to the federal government to be reconsidered?
It could, but I think the initial impact is going to be that it will probably slow the flow of immigrants into Texas, where they know they might be arrested and detained by the state, and maybe continue to push it further west to New Mexico, Arizona, California, which so far has not made an attempt to try to enforce immigration law.
And if you were under the current, you know, in this current window of time, if you were detained and or deported, and then later on the courts invalidate this law, what would happen to you?
That's an excellent point. If you're already convicted and deported, you wouldn't probably be able realistically to come back and do anything about it. If the process was still in the appellate process, which many of them will be, then if the law itself is overturned, there's no constitutional basis for bringing the prosecution, and that conviction would be overturned. So to some extent, those that are concerned about imposing a stay on this order are right. There could be some disruption, maybe not to the level of chaos, but there'll be some disruption if this law is ultimately held not to be constitutional. And in the meantime, as you point out, people have been arrested and maybe even deported.
Right. We're talking with Bill Pyatt from St. Mary's University on KTSA. Let's talk about Murthy versus Missouri. I was pointing out last hour the language Justice Jackson used in the Q&A where she worried that the First Amendment might hamstring the actions of the government, which is, of course, missing the whole point of the First Amendment.
You're right. The First Amendment says Congress shall pass no law, but then the court decisions have allowed some infringement in cases of emergency. You can't yell fire in a crowded theater. You can't incite riots, rebellion, those kind of things. But yeah, this is an important First Amendment examination where people are claiming that the federal government has interfered with the First Amendment rights of citizens by not allowing us access to information, not allowing us to even speak about some things. So the traditional view was, if there is any, quote, misinformation or disinformation, people have the freedom to listen to whatever sources of news and make their own determination as to what's misinformation or disinformation. On the other hand, there probably is some narrow circumstances where there would be an emergency, and it might be too late to wait for a lengthy academic debate about whether something was a truth or not. The government cites the pandemic, which, you know, some of those things have failed to meet the test as we look in hindsight. And then there's another question about how much is the federal government coercing media if they make friendly suggestions? Do they threaten them? At what point do you draw the line between the federal government being allowed to express its own perspective, its own view, and the federal government interfering with the First Amendment rights of the audience by prohibiting a discussion about some topics? So this will be a very interesting and probably a divisive opinion.
I find the example of COVID interesting because my recollection of that, sitting where I sit, is that a whole lot of people did a whole lot of stuff without any coercion at all. There was that kind of, hey, we're all in this together, you know, esprit de corps in the beginning, the first few weeks especially. And it was pretty clear to me that almost everybody, regardless of their politics, believed 14 days to slow the spread and 6 feet apart and, you know, wash your hands. I don't see where COVID is a case lesson in, well, we need to, in an emergency, we need to take over the information marketplace.
No, that's the one that the Biden administration cited, and they suggest there could be other emergencies similar to that, not necessarily the same thing, but there could be. I guess they could come up with a dramatic example of somebody putting something that was really harmful and really dangerous, like we're under a nuclear attack, take shelter, you know, causing a massive disruption when that was obviously not true. They might suggest something like that would be a point where the government could step in and say, hey, take that down, that's not true. But you're right.
Except that today's information marketplace guards against that more than it ever has before, with the sheer diversity of sources, plus the public's almost unprecedented skepticism about stuff that they hear. It's not 1950s America, where if it comes over a speaker, you just assume it has authority.
Unless the people don't hear any other message, unless the only message they hear is that really dramatic, frightening, untrue declaration by the government or by the private media with the coercion of the federal government to make that speech, or the coercion of the government to stop any other viewpoint from coming out. I mean, there is probably some point where the government could make some, communicate its own perspective. They get the right to do that. The question is whether they get to punish people or stop outlets from publishing a contrary view.
Is it as striking to you as it is to me that academia and the traditional left used to be the most skeptical about Big Brother, authoritarianism, question authority? It was always traditional entities like the ACLU that would defend Larry Flint. And they have completely flip-flopped into the people begging for language police.
I think you're right. Now, it's not 100% in that direction. The ACLU is representing the National Rifle Association against attempts in New York.
That is true, yeah.
To coerce banks not to do business with the NRA. But no, you're right. On the whole, the traditional liberal view, the First Amendment, the right to express, opposition, the right to politely dissent, that seems to have flipped at this point to where the left argument now is we've got to shut down this speech.
Real quick, a couple of quick things here. New York Attorney General Letitia James today is threatening to padlock Trump Tower and seize Trump assets if he doesn't make his $400+ million penalty payment. Does that sound like rhetoric to you, or do you see them going forward on that?
I think she'd try to do it. I think the courts would block that, and here's why. I think the size of that judgment is so overwhelming that nobody is going to be able to put up a bond to make that appeal, and Trump is appealing it, and he is seeking relief from that requirement to post more than $500 million bond, because nobody will issue a bond on his with him putting the properties up as collateral. They want cash, and he doesn't have that kind of cash. Nobody has that kind of cash. There is a due process argument that the Supreme Court has adopted, that if there is a punitive damage award that grossly exceeds any actual damages, that's a due process violation. There's another possible constitutional argument, and that's under the Eighth Amendment. The Eighth Amendment prohibits excessive fines. Now, this is not a criminal case that Trump's involved with, but it certainly is a fine that, at least in some view, would be excessive, because it doesn't bear any relation to any actual damages, because there were no actual damages. Nobody lost a penny as a result of what Trump was doing regarding the valuation of his property.
And he paid back the loans.
He paid back the loans, and I could see a possibility that he'd go to federal court and ask a federal court to halt the bond requirement. Without him posting a bond, he doesn't even get to appeal, which, of course, that's the reason they put such a high bond, is to stop him from appealing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would be a due process violation in itself.
And one more thing quickly. Of course, Friday we had the report from Judge McAfee in Georgia, where he told Fannie Willis either you go or Nathan Wade has to go. Nathan Wade went. But since then, it seems like the people that had been defending her smell blood in the water or taste it. And now there's a lot of liberal pundits calling for Fannie Willis to remove herself from the Trump case. As you look at this from your vantage point, is she, why are they throwing her overboard all of a sudden?
I think because they understand that if she proceeds with the prosecution and there's a conviction, Trump has a real good chance of having the case overturned on appeal for a violation of due process, conflict of interest. The trial judge didn't remove Fannie, but he said that her actions constituted an appearance of impropriety and it was cloaked with an odor of mendacity. I mean, she has no ethics and she has no common sense. If she proceeds with this trial, a conviction is going to get overturned on the basis of her misconduct.
Couldn't it be appealed anyway? I mean, hasn't her odor of mendacity already been lent to the case? Even if she left now, couldn't the Trump people say, hey, the whole thing got started by somebody who has no credibility?
Yes, they would. But their argument would be weaker if she just takes herself off the case right now. If she sticks through it, if she's sitting at that counsel table and there's a conviction, I think that's going to be grounds for a reversal in itself.
Bill Pyatt at St. Mary's University School of Law. Always appreciate it, Professor. Thanks for the extra time tonight.
Thank you, Jack.
If you're not a sports fan, you might not know who Harrison Butker is, but he's the kicker for the Kansas City Chiefs. And he also is either an altar server or a deacon at his local Catholic parish. He's very strong and outspoken about his faith, which is why he sat down and did an interview with EWTN, the Catholic news channel, recently. And in that interview, he was asked about the shooting at the Super Bowl parade this year in his home city and about gun control as a possible reaction to that parade shooting. And I want you to hear what Harrison Butker says instead. Cut number two.
I do want to ask, there is a debate in this country over the best way to curb gun violence after being so close to it.
Yeah.
Any thoughts?
Yeah. I had to do a lot of thinking about what took place at the parade. I know gun violence was a big discussion, but at the end of the day, this is degenerate violence and it should not be occurring. I think we need strong fathers in the home. I think we need men that are leading, that are setting good examples, that are teaching the young men in our society that violence is not the way to handle our disputes. It's very unfortunate what happened. Unfortunately, many, many children were injured. A beautiful young lady was killed over someone getting offended and turning to violence to handle that dispute. It's so sad. I don't think guns are the issue. I think we need fathers in the home that are being great examples for our youth.
That is a powerful statement that, at the same time, I have heard so many people say. Over the years that we've discussed various shootings, I guess going back to the 90s when we started having these high-profile school shootings in places like Mississippi and, of course, famously Columbine, there was always this dichotomy. There were always the public pronouncements and proclamations for gun control. But when you would talk to people, just people you knew, it would come up in conversation, around the table, whatever. And especially when you talk to parents or people that work with children, coaches, you would hear this over and over again. I've heard so many people say, I just wish more people who were prominent and famous and public said what Harrison Butker said. This is a violence. He called it degenerate violence. And if we don't have good examples for young people, then we will have bad outcomes. And the bad outcomes will find ways of manifesting themselves with or without guns. And many of them don't involve guns. Think about how many gratuitous and grotesque examples of random violence you've seen on, you know, X or on the news or on various screens that didn't involve a gun. And we know there's something going on with young people and what they have been shown and what they haven't been shown. We're going to talk, by the way, we've got a return guest coming to the show next hour. I know you enjoyed him last time, Christian Hodges, who's a great Young man goes to Liberty University, has written a book, has a real good sort of handle on his generation, so-called Generation Z. We're going to talk to him about this. You know, I was thinking about this story. Have you seen this story about this college student who went missing in Nashville? You know this story? It's been kind of in and out of the news. I don't think we've talked about it on this show yet. Riley Strain was his name. He was a senior at, I shouldn't say was, because hopefully, God willing, he's alive. But he's a senior at the University of Missouri. He went on a trip to Nashville with some of his fraternity brothers. They went out to a bar. He got very drunk. Everybody agrees on this. And he was asked to leave the bar because he was so drunk. And by all accounts, he's a good guy. And a whole lot of people are worried about him. He was seen sort of wandering from the bar very late at night. There's surveillance video that picks him up. Sort of, he's clearly lost. He doesn't know his way back to his hotel. He never turned up back at his hotel. The latest news over the weekend, they found his bank card on the embankment of the Cumberland River. There's fear that he may have fallen into the river. The card was not used, so it doesn't appear to have been a robbery. And so those are the bones of the story. We all hope and pray that somehow he turns up or he is okay or somebody has him, but it doesn't look good. And when I was reading the accounts of the story, something in my mind, there was something in the back of my mind that was making me think, what's missing here? I'm missing something here. I feel like I'm not getting the whole picture. And then I realized what is missing from this story is this young man was on the streets of a major city. And in the video that's been released, there's lots of other people around. And he's clearly distressed. He's walking back and forth, and he starts to go one way, and then he goes another, and he asks a police officer politely for help or direction. And it seems like there's something wrong, that somebody could be in this much distress or trouble, not out in the middle of nowhere. You know, we've heard of people disappearing on lonely country roads or in the woods, or losing their way in a desolate area. And that's tragic too, of course, but it's also understandable. There is no one around. This story is interesting because there's so many people around Riley Strain. It's just hard to believe that no one saw what happened to him. And it's also sort of sad that there didn't seem to be any help or whatever. Now, I'm not saying, don't get me wrong, that if you saw somebody late at night, obviously intoxicated, you just naturally go up to them and strike up a conversation. I totally understand why you wouldn't do that, why most people would not do that. I can understand people avoiding him or not wanting to, you know, make trouble, or you don't know if he'll become combative, or he wants money, or I mean, I get all that. I'm not faulting anybody here. But it just seems sort of tragic that he disappeared in the middle of all these people. And maybe somebody did see something and they haven't come forward, or they haven't come forward yet. But that's what makes this story different. That's what it was missing for me when I was reading through different accounts of it. And we're now through the crucial 48 hours when you know, the best chances of him being found and found safely are over. He at one point he walks into a pole, collides with a light pole. So he's very intoxicated. He's very impaired. And I know people will judge that, and people will say, well, I don't have any sympathy for some frat kid that got himself in trouble, took a trip, and, you know, he shouldn't have done what he did, and he shouldn't have been where he was, and they had the bar had to throw him out. Why are you even talking about this? I get all that. And I'll just say this. if when you were young, you never did anything stupid or dangerous or risky, that's good. That's impressive. Most of us did. Maybe not what he did, but most of us had moments in our youth that we're lucky we did not pay a price for. I know I did. I just wonder about all the people around him and no help. You know, just it's a sad thing. And I, of course, I'm thinking about what his family must be going through, and his girlfriend is looking for him, and so forth and so on. So, just a thought about that. And Chris is on the Jack Riccardi Show. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Jack and the gang and everybody out there. Hey, my comment is, where were his friends if you were too drunk? When I got too drunk a couple of times, I had them, they came after me, found me and all that, took me back to my hotel room, or one of them did, and go back to the party. I've done that for others back in my youth. Yeah, granted, we're in youth. Where are their friends? Yeah. And with all the video and where it is, no, someone, I don't know. I think bad happens. That's all.
Yeah, I'm afraid
but
so.
Yeah,
I wondered that I too. You would really think if these are people that like you, and frankly, even if they're not people that like you, there's just a gentlemanly thing. You're just supposed to make sure he gets back to the room. You know, how hard is that? I think that's a great point, Chris. Thank you. I appreciate the call. I appreciate that observation about Riley Strain. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't look good. And I know there's a lot of people looking, and there's a lot of effort, and it's received a lot of publicity. It's and it's one of those stories that people will judge the circumstances and judge that he was drunk and all that. And I get all that. He's not a totally sympathetic victim like Lakin Riley, for example. But what sort of struck me was just the it's the phenomenon of the modern world. You can be more alone in a crowd than when you're alone. I mean, even in your own life, you can be the loneliest you've ever been in a house with people that don't like you or love you or hate you. You could live alone. You could be in a room completely alone and not be as lonely as it feels when you are with people that don't care about you. And our world is now full of people moving around, moving amongst us. We're around other people. They're around us. You see them. They see you. And we think we're in a crowd, but really a lot of the people you see every day are the loneliest people they've ever been. You just don't think of it because visually they look like they're surrounded. And he, in these videos, is surrounded by people, but he's alone. This young man is on his own. Next guest, he's back with us. Christian Hodges is 18 years old, a powerful conservative voice and Gen Z advocate and a student at Liberty University. He wrote a book called America, Don't Give Up. The last time he was with us, his message was about Generation Z and not giving up or giving in to some of the pessimistic portrayals of them. And Christian, welcome back. It's great to have you back on the show.
Jack, thanks for having me. It's really good to be back. It's really an honor.
Well, we love having you. And you wrote an opinion piece over at Newsmax about the TikTok ban bill, which we've been talking about a lot on the show, and pointing out that it is about much more than TikTok. It has implications beyond TikTok. It's very popular right now to point out the Chinese linkage and control. And, of course, this bill would require ByteDance to divest itself of TikTok. Why are you concerned about and referring to this as a highly dangerous move?
Of course, Jack. Well, I think if we look at the bill and look at, like, who voted for it, it's really an interesting grouping of names. People who voted for it, almost a unanimous passage. Only about 50, 60 people voted against it. Of the people who voted for it, Speaker Mike Johnson, Nancy Pelosi, Freedom Caucus Chair Bob Good, the people who voted against it, Matt Gaetz, Alex Mooney, AOC, and the rest of her squad.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big gap that we have here. A lot of people, even President Biden, has come out and said they're trying to ban TikTok because it's a significant threat to national security. That's what it says throughout the bill. But there's one clause that sounds later on that really corrupts this entire reasoning. Because, yes, TikTok is owned by the Chinese government. But if you read later on, it's in Section 2, Clause 3. And the name of this bill is H.R. 7521. You go look it up on the government websites, H.R. 7521. Section 2, Clause 3, it's talking about how the bill is branded to protect us from apps controlled by foreign adversaries, as they state it. So many of us would think this would mean it protects us from someone like China or Russia interfering with us, right? But as Representative Thomas Massie from Kentucky, he pointed out in a tweet the other day, and he said that this bill really expands the phrase's definition of foreign adversaries to the point that the president of the United States, whether it is Biden at the moment or it's Trump in the future or it's someone completely different, whoever that president is at the moment, is given the power to ban websites, not just apps. I think this is a large expansion of our government, far more than the founding fathers ever envisioned for the president to have the power of. He doesn't need the approval of Congress or anyone. He can do it with one swipe of a pen. And as Elon Musk pointed out, I mean, this law is not just about TikTok. It's about censorship and government control. And Elon Musk, we all know him as a warrior for freedom of speech. As a young Gen Zer, 18 years old myself, freedom of speech is my key issue. I think it's under attack more than anything else, because it's really the linchpin of our liberties, as I say in my book. That's really my main point, my book, America Don't Give Up, that if we remove freedom of speech, do we have any other freedom? I think this bill is really an attack against our freedom of speech. It really gives the government more power, more control, so that they're continually to move in the direction of 1984. And as I said on Fox and Friends last September when I was on, I said, with each day that passes, it appears more so as if the Biden administration is using 1984, George Orwell's dystopian novel, as an instruction manual instead of something to shy away from. I think this bill right here, H.R. 7521, is living proof of that statement.
Well, let me ask you this, because now we have this going on, and we have the Supreme Court hearing Murthy versus Missouri, which is also about the notion that the government needs to pick and choose for us what can be in the marketplace of ideas. These this concept of speech policing, as you know, Christian, in survey after survey, is more popular with people your age than with any other age group. How did that come to pass?
Well, I think we've committed intellectual suicide. As hard as it is to say, I mean, the past 20, 30 years, the past few decades of American education has been filled with Marxist roots. There's a popular interview that oftentimes goes around where there's this Russian official who's talking to an interviewer, a journalist, back in 1984, I believe it is. And he says, the journalist asks him, how would you take over America? And the Russian says, well, I would demoralize the nation. How do we do that, he asks. And the Russian says, I would re-educate two whole generations. And what have we seen them do the past 20, 30 years? They've taken millennials, and they've taken my generation. And they were trying to, at least. And we have a fight to wage right now. But
so in other words, you're saying that people your age have been educated that free speech is dangerous, it's unfettered, it's like a wild animal in our midst. And how do you reverse that fear that they have of something that you perceive as a strength or as a virtue? How do you undo the damage that you say has been done?
And simply, there's a couple of things we can do, but most simply, we have to go back to the basics. We look at, I know I grew up playing sports throughout my childhood, and most people did, of course. When we get into like the preseason of a sports team, what does the coach do? He goes over the fundamentals, right? He goes over the basic things we need to do as a team, just the simplest things we can do. And then we start the season, we start winning. Say we go on a 5-game winning streak, and then we drop 3 in a row. What happens that very next practice after we're on a 3-game losing streak? The coach doesn't go over advanced techniques. He goes back to the basics, and he reinforces what he did in the preseason. The same is true for our nation. We were founded at a very strong point in 1776, and it was the Constitution following about 10 years later, 1787. But now we've gone on a winning streak, and now we're losing. We're going on the downward trajectory. How do we get back? Go back to the basics. And I think when we look at the biggest threat to freedom of speech today, what I talk about in the book is hate speech. These calls for all these hate speech laws. I'm offended by what you said. Thus, you should go to jail. You misgendered me. Like the Michigan law says, you should be charged with a felony and $10,000. But at the root of hate speech laws is the fear of self-censorship. I'm not going to say what I truly believe, because I think it's going to offend someone, and they're not going to be happy with me afterwards. I think Gen Z really needs to realize that it's their privilege to say what they think. And the less they say what they think, the less they're going to even have that privilege. As Eric Metaxas says in Letters to the American Church, he says, let me pull it up here really quick. He says, when people fail to speak, the price of speaking rises. As the price of speaking rises, so fewer speak out, until a whole nation or culture is silenced. I think that's what we're seeing going on today. So how do we reverse course, going back to the basics? I think we have to first, the three-step plan, have to first respond to the speech that we don't like. Tell the person why you don't like what they said, why it offended you if it did. And then, secondly, we have to educate ourselves. You have to go back to the basics, educate yourself on the objective truth. Why did it offend me? But what is the truth of the matter? The other person who offended you has to do the same on their side of things. And thirdly, you have to come back to the table. We have to return to civil debates. That's the biggest thing I think our nation, our culture, even the world is lacking. Everyone is afraid to have a discussion because they're afraid they'll offend someone.
Yeah, we actually speak of it today as a virtue. We say, oh, let's not talk about politics, or let's not, right? People consider it almost impolite. Yeah. And yet I remember when I was your age and I was at college, I was always excited to meet somebody that I disagreed with or came from a different background, because now you were going to have a really great debate, and you were going to maybe learn something and win a few points and lose a few points. We've turned that into some sort of, you know, negative.
I think you're completely right. And one thing my dad has really drilled into my head my whole life is the fact that we ought to strive to be lifelong learners. And we've really gone away from that, because we've said that, oh, I'm content where I am. I don't need anything more. I don't need anything less. And we've really forsaken the product of our republic, which is disagreement. If we can't accept that we can disagree with someone, but we can actually have a conversation about it, what can we speak about? Because you and I don't agree on everything. We can't. No two people agree on everything, as Ben Carson says. And if they did, one of them wouldn't be necessary.
When you look at the discourse over, for example, Donald Trump, you realize that we have people in this country who really believe that their political opponents should be killed or should be deported. And I don't know how much of that is we've convinced ourselves of that, and how much of that is it's kind of in vogue to overstate it, and, you know, everybody's trying to outdo everybody in terms of draconian language. But it makes political discourse dangerous.
Oh, it definitely does. Persecuting political opponents is exactly what regimes do. This is what, I mean, Russia has done in the past however long Putin has been in power. This is what Hitler did to gain power. This is how Kim Jong-un got power from his family. He killed his family members, right? So he can rise to the top. That's exactly what we're seeing in our country. It's quite scary for myself, knowing that my generation is the future of this nation, if we have a nation by then. In my book, I interviewed someone who fled from China. He was a political refugee. His family, they were very religious. They were Christian, like myself. And they were holding these they're holding church within their house, and the government eventually raided their house while they were on vacation, and they got word of that, and eventually fled China because of the religious persecution. And then as he came to America, he started going to school. He eventually went to UC Berkeley, California, a very liberal school. And then he graduated law school from Regent University, which is a very conservative school in Virginia Beach. And he tells me about his stories from what he saw from the far left and what he saw from the far right. And really, he said at the very end of that question, he said, when freedom of speech comes together, there will be disagreements. And I think that's at the root of the government overreach that we're seeing today, is that the government wants to have so much control over your and I's life that we can't disagree, because everything we say, do, and think is in line with the government.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly mm-hmm. what the goal of the Oceania government was in 1984
right.
by Orwell.
Right.
Was to
right.
control the each individual identity of a human being.
Right. Well, and as you said, the point of that book is to not do that. It's not a how-to.
Mm-hmm.
Christian, yeah, always enjoy our time together. I want to have you back again soon. I hope we can do that. If you want to read Christian's book, it's called America, Don't Give Up. Christian Hodges, the author. And Christian, you have a good night, and thank you for coming on today.
Of course, Jack. Thanks for having me. Look forward to next time.
We'll do that. Talk to you soon. Next half hour, the results on today's JR poll powered by River City Oral Surgery. Louise Mayer is a member of parliament in Sweden who was known for advocating for open borders back during the refugee crisis several years ago. She was one of those who said that it was important to welcome refugees. It was who we are. She used to take the position that Swedish society should be about openness and welcoming. That was her mantra. She came out recently and said she has completely changed her mind. And she now wants the people she said should be welcomed to be deported. She supports even stricter migration policies now than the policies she opposed then. And what she points to, and I, you know, say what you want, but you got to give a person in public life credit for changing it, you know, changing their mind or changing their vote publicly. I mean, that's rare. She says what she sees is how seriously organized immigrant crime has become in her communities, and that the new arrivals are not self-sufficient and are not assimilating in Swedish society. Now, if you think about most other countries, they're not as set up for assimilation and, you know, variety as we are. It's often said we're a nation of immigrants, but what we really are is a nation that has grown through legal immigration. We are built for the kind of pressures and load that brings. Most countries are not. And the immigration crises of the last decade were the first time any of these countries ever had mass migration or mass attempted immigration. And they were, I think, incredibly naive about it. And they were, I think, corrupt about it, quite frankly. I think they lied to themselves. They lied to their people. And she now says she wants stricter limits on immigration than were in place when she was calling for basically open borders. Louise Mayer in Sweden. We haven't talked a lot about Haiti lately, but that, of course, is continuing to unravel. I read today that in the years since the 2010 earthquake, now, that was the turning point for Haiti. Haiti was a poor country before the earthquake. Haiti was a desperately poor, failed state after that earthquake in 2010. Since that time, Haiti has received almost $14 billion through international efforts led by the U.S. and the U.N. It has, in other words, received more than the country's total GDP. And right now, the Biden administration is talking about hundreds of millions of dollars to help Haiti in this criminal gang crisis that they're going through. But when you look back at what happened after 2010, none of the promises were kept. The capital city, Port-au-Prince, was not rebuilt. Infrastructure like sanitation, electricity, wasn't built and rebuilt. You see people walking in dirt roads. And people that have done charitable work there, like Jack Brewer, the former NFL player, say the money vanished. There's no sign that this little tiny country was the focus of all this allocation of money. And basically, it's a story of graft. It's a story of corruption. And by the way, I don't think that was all Haitian graft and corruption. I think there's probably a long and shameful list of Americans, including the Clintons, who probably did very, very well off the fundraising over Haiti. So Haiti, in a way, is almost like a blue city, if you think about it. It's a place where there is undoubtedly suffering and privation and need. Everyone can see that. It's a place where people are lacking the basics of a civilized life. It's been the focus group of tremendous spending and big promises too, big talk, big rhetoric. Haiti was going to be a model for the Caribbean. Haiti was going to be a model for democracy in the region, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The very same people, many of them, who've made those promises about our cities and never delivered, made those promises about Haiti and never delivered. And as with our big cities, no one knows where the money went. All the money that's been allocated for homelessness, where'd it go? Who made money off this? Because people are still homeless more than ever. Somebody got that money. Somebody made money plucking the heartstrings of other people. And I think they used Haiti very much the way they use our American cities. Anyway, we'll see. We'll talk about it. Time now on the Jack Riccardi Show for us to check the Jack Chat line, the number that we keep open all the time. So if you're listening to the live show, you're listening to the podcast of this show, after hours, weekends, nights, what have you, or you just didn't think of something to say at the time we were on a topic and then it pops into your head later, you call this number, 210-599-5550. Give us first name, give us a city or town, give us a comment just like this.
Hi, Jack. This is Jim from Virginia Beach, Virginia. The idea of voting for a president because you might like him or because, you know, who you want to have a beer with. I mean, that, it seems, the best I remember seemed to have started with stuff like Bill Clinton. Does he wear boxers or briefs and playing the saxophone? And then going on to crazy stuff like that. I mean, who cares about that? Who you'd want to have a beer with? You're not going to have a beer with the president. So what's the difference? You know, and even this, and now I heard today we're talking about, misconstruing statements and the media jumping to conclusions and misleading. And then it goes back to, as far as, you know, Barack Obama with his former college professor that got asked by the police why he was going into a house. And then it's, and, you know, Obama's first response, well, I don't know what was wrong, but I know the police, I don't know what happened, but I know the police are stupid. You know, that was his initial response without knowing any of the facts. That's what's going on. Have a good day. Thank you.
Okay. I think he said the Cambridge police acted stupidly, I think is what President Obama said about Professor Gates at that time. You know, when people, it's funny, whenever people cite, like, past presidential episodes, all of which at the time we talked about on talk radio and we took very seriously, I hear them and I think now, man, I'd love to go back to those days. It would be such a relief if we were talking about Clinton boxers or briefs compared to now. Right? I mean, you didn't know at the time, but that doesn't look so bad now. Now that we have you-know-who and you-know-what. So, next on the Jack Chat line.
Hi, Jack. This is Scott from Schertz. It's Friday. I was calling in about, you were talking about inspections. Here in Schertz, I go to Brad's Oil, and they've been checking my brakes. They drive the car for 10, 15 years now. So I don't know if just some places do it or not. But, yeah, they take your car and drive it, check the brakes, and then they pull it in and go through the inspection. But that's the first thing they do is check your brakes. Thank you. Bye.
I am still getting so many emails, Don Cooper. It's now very clear to me that
you think you were ruse.
I was pranked. Yeah, I was pranked. I went to a place to get the inspection.
Yes.
They did all the normal things they've always done,
mm-hmm.
and then they had me. They gave me the piece of paper that says you've been inspected and you passed inspection. You pay them $7. I paid them the $7, and then I pulled out. They said pull along the side of the building. It was an oil change place, and they said, now we want you to gun it down the side of the building, and when we signal, you look in your rearview mirror, because when we signal you, you're going to slam on the brakes. That's the brake test. And like an idiot, instead of going, what the hell are you talking about? I did it. I complied. And then the guy just waved. He was a little tiny figure in my rearview mirror at this point. He just gave me the, okay, you're good to go. See you later.
And went back to the office to look at the video.
And laughed their asses off. Yes. Guy wrote to me and said, I went to a Valvoline for an inspection. The exact same thing happened to me with the brake test. It freaked me out. I think I was pranked, too. Nobody has written to me and said that is a normal standard procedure. The thing about them testing your brakes would make sense. Like, if they drove the car, I could see that. But having you slam on your own brakes is not a brake test. That's crazy. So, next on the Jack Chat line.
Jack, you're doing best concerts. Steve Miller's homestand in Dallas in the 90s was good. Ray Wiley Hubbard playing the Shriner Quad was good. An honorable mention, best half concert would be Hot House Flowers opening for Midnight Oil. Neil Young was overrated, and the only good thing about Blind Melon was the fact that I got to claim I can see him. I saw him before the overdose took place. Have a good one.
Thank you, Esteban. Yeah, we're still getting a lot of emails about best concert you ever saw. That was a very popular.
I heard Neil Young's back on Spotify. Is that correct?
He asked them to put his music back on because he admitted
protest.
That. Who was it that he was? Was it Joe Rogan that he was objecting to?
Yes, it was. Mm-hmm.
And he admitted that Rogan is everywhere, so that didn't work. He was not a. He was he and the combined efforts of Neil Young and like two or three other crispy granola rockers did not stop Joe Rogan. So, do we have another one? Can we put one more on?
Good evening there, Jack Riccardi.
Oh,
this is Gordon.
Listen to that.
Got in a little late last night on your best concerts of all time, of all the wild and crazy concerts me and the wife been to in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Had to be Little Feet. Early 90s, San Antonio, Texas, Majestic Theater. Great show. 4 hours, no backup band. 4 hours of just good jamming music. And that was the greatest show I've ever seen. Thank you much. Have a good night. Adios.
All right. Play the beginning of that again. I love the way he starts that call, Don.
Good evening there, Jack Riccardi.
That is now the new, I think that should now be the new,
we have to,
like, official intro of our show.
Cut that out of there and use it every
I
now
like
and then,
that.
Maybe.
I like the way he says it. Has a, it feels a little like a WWE kind of, good evening.
Do we have to?
He does it better than I do.
Do we have to get Gordon's permission to use?
Gordon, may we have your permission to use that? Let us know, please. I want to use that. I saw a little feat around the time he did, the early 90s. They opened for Styx, where I saw them. And I'm not a fan of either of those bands, but they were actually better than Styx, even though they were the opening act. You ever see a concert where the opening act was better?
Yes, in fact. It was Frank Sinatra when he was in San Antonio. Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet was the...
You're saying Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet were better than Frank Sinatra?
Yes, I have
because
to.
Because he was old? Is that what you
yes,
mean?
Yes, he was yeah. way past his prime, unfortunately. Yeah. And it was really hard to watch, you know, because you think, you know, this is an iconic entertainer yeah. of all things.
I know, they
you
play
know?
Some of the live stuff from like 93 mm. on the Sinatra satellite channel, and I have to turn it off. I can't, not that I'm being disrespectful of him, it just hurts too much to hear him like that.
It was know? Yeah, it was hard to watch. I mean, I enjoyed it, and I can say that I actually, you know, witnessed
yeah.
Frank Sinatra, but it definitely was not in his prime, unfortunately.
I could see where Steve and Edie would be pretty. They were
yeah,
they were good right up until the end.
They really yeah, were.
They were show people. You know who else was really good? He was always good right up until the end was Andy Williams.
Never had the privilege of seeing him in
he always
concert.
Had a, you know? Yeah, he always had a lot of energy yeah, and had a great voice that held up over a long time. All right, these two old people on the radio talking about dead artists.
I was thinking the same thing.
So what happened to the Gen Z guy? Can we get him back? People are like, bring back that Gen Z guy. I read in New York City there is a robot barista. There's a coffee place in Hudson Yards that has a his name is Jarvis. And he can make all kinds of coffee drinks. He's at a home goods store, a Japanese home goods store that has a coffee bar in it. And Jarvis can make you a, you know, an espresso or a mocha latte or a cappuccino or whatever you want. People enjoy watching him. He makes eye contact with customers while taking their order, which you put in on a connected iPad. And often compliments the choice of beverage, like tells you you've made a good choice or that's going to be good. And then he makes it. The weird part, as I was reading about this, is that people tip him. Now, I realize we're in some uncharted waters here, but why would you tip a robot? Right? I mean, I know why we tip. Let's not open that can of worms. I know why we tip human beings and people that serve us, and we should, and we do. I don't see tipping a robot would be like tipping a vending machine. Like, what do you buy the Coke out of the vending machine, you give the vending machine a little something extra. Hey, good job dropping that can down into the little bucket. Yeah, you did that really well. Way to deliver those Ruffles potato chips down to the front of the machine. Extra something for you here. I don't see tipping a robot. I'm sorry. Is that wrong? Am I being cruel? Am I being unkind? He doesn't have feelings. You know? Save your money. Tip the real people, if there still are any. Throwback Thursday this week is going to be 1978. And as you will find out, the country was in the throes of a phenomenon this week in 1978. I mean, there was something going on that was so big. You know what I'm talking about, Don Cooper. You couldn't get away from it. I mean, it was all pervasive. Everybody was in it and on it and about it.
And the word begins with a D, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're
thinking?
Yeah,
well, one of the words, yeah. It's not just disco. It's even more specific than that. Oh, yeah, I mean, okay. It was the disco era. But I'm talking about a cultural event. A cultural event. I don't know if we get this way around things like television shows and movies now, like back in the day. You know, there's so many, we're in so many places. All of us are in so many different places and following so many different things. But anyway, that'll be coming up on Thursday. On the JR poll tonight, getting back to the present, River City Oral Surgery, JR poll, should social media companies take direction from this or any administration? Nobody liked that idea on the poll. It was 100% no on that. Remember I told the story a few weeks ago of a guy I was working out, and a guy had a Trump Vivek sweatshirt on. He really wants to see Trump pick Vivek Ramaswamy as his running mate. Trump has now said, according to Bloomberg News, that Vivek is off the list for VP. He will not be the running mate, but he would be interested in having Vivek Ramaswamy in his cabinet and possibly Homeland Security Secretary, which is an interesting idea. So Trump is looking for a running mate who, quote, isn't motivated by the limelight. Gosh, I wonder why that is. I wonder what that could be about. And somebody that will give him an edge. And he says that a lot of the people that the names are suggested to him, he's not that impressed with. And see, I think that we all, when we try to play this game, we're like matchmaking, right? We're thinking, well, who would go with him? But presidential candidates don't want somebody like them. That's the whole point of it. So we'll see what happens. But I still think we're going to be surprised. I think it's going to wind up being somebody that isn't being rumored and talked about. Don, you had an interesting thought.
Yeah.
What was your name you were thinking?
You know what? The more I think about this, I'm looking at Pompeo.
Mike Pompeo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you get the whole foreign policy, military. Yeah,
I know they bumped heads. I know Pompeo had reservations about his relationship with Putin, but
according to the Bloomberg story, Kevin McCarthy is rumored to be a candidate for chief of staff, which I think is not going to please a lot of people, but we'll see. Tomorrow we do it again. We talk about what's going on in the news, what's going on in our lives, and you can be a part of it live starting at 4 here on KTSA, or look for the Jack Riccardi Show podcast wherever you like to get your other podcasts.